The next case is 95-1042, Joan Roberts, Executrix versus Ohio Permanente Medical Group. Are you going to argue first?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. You may proceed.
May it please this honorable court, we would like to reserve 4 minutes for the final
clock. Time there, clock.
The result in the Cooper case prevents a known number of people in the state of Ohio who have an inherent and guaranteed right to be compensated for any wrong or death caused by negligence. It disenfranchises them, those people who have a diagnosis of liver cancer, esophageal cancer. And those people, statistically, do not have a better than even chance of living at the time their disease is diagnosed. So that by the effect of injecting the better than 50% chance rule, they have a zero chance. On the scale of 0 to 100, of 0 being no chance of life, they are considered to have no chance of living at all. This is an unfair and unjust interpretation of the law.
Would it not just be as unfair for the medical professional to rule the other way? For instance, if it's 51%, then there's liability. If there's 49%, there is not. Would it not be unfair saying if there's 28% is here, that's unfair to the medical profession?
Not if it is on a relative scale, Your Honor. It is, I would contend that the better than 50% rule, which says that 51% guarantees a certainty of life, is just as inequitable as saying that 50% chance guarantees death. It's an artificial injection of a 50%, better than 50% rule that is not fair. The concept is not fair.
I think that's exactly my point, that whichever way you do it, it's unfair to somebody.
That's right, so it shouldn't be done that way.
Well, it's unfair, shouldn't be done that way. Well, they think it should be, because it's unfair to them if we overrule Cooper. What about the proposition that if you took your particular case and found, and I was struck this morning by the news that Brett Butler, the center fielder for the Dodgers, was just yesterday found to have throat cancer when they took out his tonsil. And on the way down, I heard that he had a 70% chance of recovery. Now, under this, our case law, no question, it goes forward. He has, if they had not discovered it, and it had gone down to 45%, then under our case law, he'd had no chance. What about applying the percentage to whatever a jury might give? For instance, if there's a $100,000 verdict, apply 28% to it.
Well, I think the whole concept should be one of comparison. Then it's fair to both sides. If as we do in every tort case, this is really a confusion of the way cases are argued with the way the law ought to state the cause of action. Because there's always the argument of how much injury did the negligence cause? Did it cause little injury? Then there will be little recovery. Did it cause great injury? Then there'll be great recovery. Why is it that a certain group is excluded, and why is it that a certain number of doctors would be required to pay full damages when their negligence on a scale of 0 to 100 is not 100%? It is not 100% certain. 51% does not mean 100% certainty. And less than 50% does not mean a zero certainty. That's why it is unfair.
Sounds to me like you're arguing for my percentage formula.
Well, I think I'm arguing for a comparison, which is what you're saying. That would be fair to both. I mean, that is what ends up being done in all cases.
But you don't get that by following propositions 2, 3, and 4 that you presented, which specifically say overrule Cooper. Because if you overrule Cooper, it goes exactly the opposite direction.
Well, you can overrule Cooper, you can modify Cooper, you can redefine causation. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. I think that's what we've got now. We've got an all or nothing situation, which is basically unfair, and which the argument on the other side is that's the way we want it to be.
Your argument did seem as if, when I read the briefs, it did seem as if this is like comparative negligence, although, of course, we don't have, one party's not negligent, the ill person's not negligent, but that's really what some of the states have adopted is essentially what you're saying.
Well, most of them, I think that's true, Your Honor. Most of them have adopted what could better be called a comparative causation, looking to and stating and recognizing the substantive right. They have looked to a comparative causation, and they use it in terms of a substantial causative factor, in other words, like that. And I think that the states have adopted this, that have adopted some change in the 50%, better than 50% rule, have tried to modify it so to take the harsh edges off, which not only the argument that it just gives the injured and the dying an advantage, it gives on the other side, it gives an advantage to the healthcare providers. So I think the result that should obtain is to change it and make it fair.
That seems attractive and seems reasonable until we get up against our traditional concepts of proximate cause. What happens to proximate cause in the traditional sense?
Where did the magic 50% come from? I mean, I think it came from a retrospective look at it that says, well, if someone is convinced of the truth of something or that something is more likely, then it must be better than 50%. If we talk about a 50-50 chance, an even chance, look at other standards of proof. How much of a percentage does it take to reach clear and convincing evidence?
Well, there's the difference between possibility and probability. Isn't that how we got there?
But who put the magic 50% in there? This is what it has done. It said if you don't have a better than even chance, you have nothing.
Which position the other states have four different variations on this issue.
Maybe.
And each has some variation to it, but which are, I think your brief advocated adopting the restatement.
Well, the restatement, it's an interpretation of the restatement, and it's using the restatement to get to a point that perhaps the restatement doesn't directly and obviously point to, and that is looking at it from the increased risk. It's just calling it. Well, the test would be the substantial causative factor is creating a substantive right in an increased risk of death. I mean, it's just the other side of the coin of looking at the rate of survival. But my point was about difference. You're talking about the standards of proof. Where is there a percentage in clear and convincing? How much percentage do you have to be beyond reasonable doubt? 72%, 90%?
I
I'd like to look at the damages side of it. If this person, had she been properly diagnosed, had 28% chance of survival. The flip side of that is she had a 72% chance she was going to die anyway.
72%, yes.
What are you proposing as a measure of damages if we accept your proposition that this woman had a 3/4 chance of dying anyway had she been properly diagnosed? What are you assessing the damages against the medical profession under that case?
Well, recognizing that 28 people out of 100 are going to get a cure, and that she has been deprived of that. And how do you measure it? You could measure it as we're talking about comparative. If there is a value to the person's life that is established, that a jury would answer like an interrogatory in our comparative, if you would say it's worth $1 million, then you would apply a percentage to it.
Is that how the other states do it?
That's done in some states. That's done. I'm not sure whether they do it with an interrogatory or not.
The majority of the states follow the rule as it is in Ohio.
I don't think they do. There's an argument in the brief, and I found that there are more cases decided that don't use the 50-50 rule, the better than 50% rule. Now, there is no majority in the way they approach it, but there was one statement that I found yesterday in talking about Connecticut itself not having the laws of the chance doctrine, and the latest case they cited was in 1987, and there's a 1990 case specifically that says that, so I'm not sure today.
Your basic thesis is that the percentage of survival should be a factor in the measure of damages rather than the determination of the action.
Absolutely.
The cause of action.
Absolutely. And then there would be no argument that the medical profession generally would be responsible for those damages that they shouldn't.
Justice Douglas, I believe, and Justice Stradwell asked, would you make it then a mathematical formula that is applied, or would it be something that both sides just get to argue? Isn't that an awfully tough position for a defendant to say, well, jury, don't hit us too hard because this lady only had a 1/3 chance of living, so go a little easy. You're a good advocate to imagine yourself having to stand up in the courtroom and say that to a jury. That you're going to be very hard to.
Well, I don't know. I think you face that in every argument. If you've got a case where you have some way to minimize the damages by some reasonable and logical argument, I think that the public is aware of the survivability.
But I guess what I'm asking is should it be a mathematical formula, and should that formula be in the jury's hands, or should that be something the judge applies? In other words, the parties arrive at some stipulation, or the jury determines what they think the chances of survival were, and then the judge afterwards applies the mathematical
formula. Well, I think any evidence regarding the chances of survival, in all medical malpractice cases, there are experts on either side proposing their expert opinions, and I think there would be that same back and forth in these kinds of cases. I don't know, the only experience we have is a legislative enactment that says that the jury shall determine full damages and then shall apply a percentage. You can do that with jury instructions, or you can do that with a formula. And you can if the common law.
Well, what do you think is the fair thing? I mean, you're here saying,
I don't think
take this rule down because it's not fair, it's not just. We have to replace it with something that is more fair and more just, and what is that?
Well, I guess my position would be, Your Honor, that I don't think the mechanics are as important as the establishment of the rule of law. If the rule of law is there, that there shall be a right of recovery, With respect to the amount of damage done, then the mechanics, I think, are irrelevant. The mechanics would be the same as they are in every tort case.
And with your example, let's take that further. If the jury awards us more than $1 million and then they take 28%, you would have to say to the medical profession, you have to pay this woman $250,000, even though it's more probable than not she was going to die regardless. That's the message that we would be sending to the medical profession. That's their medical profession making up on everything.
I think that's true, because no matter what you say about more likely than not, there are 28 people that are going to be cured, and this person has no interest in that 28 under the law, and they do, in fact, in life. So I think it's more unfair to say you have no right at all than to say in the medical profession, instead of excusing you for depriving how many people you can number of a 50-50 chance, you say to the medical profession, we're going to take away that grant that we gave you to be negligent and to take away a 50-50 chance for every person that has lung cancer or esophagus cancer or liver cancer, and make you responsible for the effect of your negligence on their actual life, on what they have been deprived of, which is knowing there are 28 people that are going to be cured. So I think, yes, it is saying something to them that they will be responsible for their negligence, and they're not going to be excused anymore, and they will be in that category where we will have a comparison, where we will weigh your negligence, and we will make you responsible not for 100% of your negligence when you only caused them to slip over the line 51%. So we're going to be more fair to you on that end.
Does adoption of 323 automatically overrule Cooper?
I don't think so. And I don't think that automatically we're saying, it looks like, that I'm saying that Cooper has to be modified substantially so that the harsh result is not going to continue in view of where we stand in the medical profession.
So in your proposition of Law 3, as an example, it could just as easily have said, citation Section 323 approved and followed, Cooper versus Sisters of Charity modified.
Right, that's it's not enough, but it's the idea.
You've used your time, Mr. Lancey. Now, Mr. Severello, rebuttal, if you take rebuttal. Mr. Rice? Mr. Rice, I see that three of you are going to argue. You need to watch your time closely, because it's difficult to get three arguments in, I found, with 15 minutes. So, watch your time.
May it please the Court, my name is Jay Rice, and I represent the defendant at the Appellee's Ohio Clemente Medical Group, Dr. Shaw. And I will be sharing my time with Mr. Strong, who represents the hospital. I'll try to use 8 or 9 minutes, reserving 5 for him, and a minute or two for Catherine Ballard, who represents the Hospital Association, Ohio State Medical Association. As this Court knows, it's well established in Ohio that to establish a claim for medical malpractice, but it must prove through expert testimony a causal link between a physician's negligence and the injury sustained. This requires evidence that the doctor's negligence, improbability, caused injuries or death. And this is indeed true of any civil tort claim in Ohio. There must be a causal nexus between the alleged negligence and the resulting harm in order to hold the defendant liable in damages. This is the fundamental principle of our civil justice system. And it's this fundamental principle which the appellants seek to have this Court discard.
If we didn't have to worry about our traditional thoughts about proximate cause, wouldn't it be fair to adopt the views of one of the states? There are several views here, as you've indicated in your brief, and appellants, of course, have acknowledged that there are different ways one can look at this. And wouldn't it seem fair to look at this issue in a comparison context, that much as we do with comparative negligence, obviously the patient is not negligent, but wouldn't that be fair to say that the hospital can or doctor can be found to be liable for negligence, but we're gonna factor in the fact that the person had some prospect of life?
And as this court noted 25 years ago in Cooper, there's sort of an intuitive sense that we'd like to do that.
Right.
And the court rejected it 25 years ago, realizing that the harm in the long run may be greater than the benefit. And I think what the courts, which have adopted this theory, have overlooked is what the role of law is. What is the purpose of a civil trial? And certainly we don't require absolute certainty in causation. We don't require the intent to prove that this doctor absolutely positively caused harm. We accept something less than that in our system of justice. But there has to be some degree of certainty. Because
are you saying that the states that have adopted this rule have abandoned the idea of the legal theory of proximate cause?
They have. They absolutely have. There have been courts that have adopted loss of chance by adopting a theory of relaxed causation. So that if it's pretty sure, maybe 30-40% substantial factor.
Well, that's not an abandonment.
Well, except that other courts will say any increase in the chance of death. That's enough. Others will simply relax causation and require a substantial factor. Others will tell that once you show an increased risk, you apportion it in terms of damages.
What is it? Can't you turn this causation argument right on its head and say that the rules we now have in Ohio is just the reverse? If you're below 50%, it's an absolute that there's not causation. And that's not really true either. That's a legal fiction as well.
It's a legal fiction to this extent. We search for the truth as best we can. It's not a perfect system.
Well, counsel, as a practicing attorney, if someone comes to you with a case that you evaluate as being poor at best, 15% chance of recovery, but you agree to take that case on, and then you blow the statute of limitations, you don't get to go into court and say, Your Honor, no causation, no case against me for malpractice, do you?
In a situation like that, if in all probability, the defendant, our client's lawyer, not just the legal for me, but in that case, if the defendant can say, you would have lost the case, that's the trial within a trial concept of legal malpractice. So then you try the underlying case to find out whether or not it had merit or not. But there will be a jury determination as to whether or not that claim had merit or not. And that must be a finding by preponderance of the evidence. Again, there must be some degree of certainty.
But there's no absolute bar. I mean, you're going to potentially face a cause of action, and a jury's going to make a call on that malpractice claim.
What if, for example, and to use your example, the underlying case had to do with the lost chance doctrine, and the underlying plaintiff could not prove the case? And I said, maybe I have a chance to get the House Supreme Court to get it reversed. Probably not. If the rule of law says that, indeed, there was no valid underlying claim, should they go to the jury because possibly something might different occur if you'd only taken the case? And it goes back to what a whole system of civil justice is all about. And I think by trying to come up with a way of harshening the edges, you have to look that ours is not a perfect system. You have to show some degree of certainty of a causal relationship between the actor's alleged negligence and the resulting harm.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Shouldn't the law keep up with other advancements in society?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm glad you brought that up because the most recent decisions have reaffirmed Cooper and followed Cooper. The Maryland Supreme Court?
It's been my observation that in every newspaper article, every article written on television, anything, they have stressed early detection means life. Never not.
Yes, sir.
And every day we advance in the cure of things 10 or 15 or 20 years ago were death sentences. There was no cure, he dies, period. So it's my way of thinking that the law should progress with everything else, and in today's society, the quicker you can find out you're sick, the quicker of your chances of survival. Now, why should then we not advance and say, listen, if you examine someone and you missed the cancer, and 3 years later they discovered it, why should we, and you've only got 25% of survival at that time when it was discovered, why shouldn't we enable that person to say, listen, 3 years ago, I came to you, you missed it. You cut off my chance of living entirely. You missed it. Now we're going to say, too bad, you only have a 25% rate of the possibility of surviving. That's just your tough luck. Why should we do that?
Because the law is not a lottery system and it's not insurance. There must be some way of establishing that the doctor probably was the cause of the harm.
Well, shouldn't that person cut off my life by not discovering something? Shouldn't he have to answer for that?
Because probably the doctor did not, using your example. In all probability, using your example, the doctor did not cause the harm.
But you're going around my example. Early discovery means living. And the earlier you discover something, the better the probability of he had. Well, who's to say if he hadn't discovered it 3 years ago, I'd have a 90% chance of survival, and I'd be walking around today. Why should we cut that person's right off?
Well, using that example, if there was truly a 90% chance of survival,
well, who's to say? Who's to say? Well, you can't say it's not. You can't say a missed examination 3 years ago wouldn't give me 90% rate of survival. How would you say that?
If an expert can come forward and say, in my opinion, to a reasonable degree of certainty, that patient would survive.
Yes, but the creature cuts off all of my chances if I don't have 50% or more chance of survival when I finally discover I'm sick.
If you come to the doctor, you're probably going to die.
Yeah, I thought, let me make sure I understand the facts here. I thought the medical testimony was that even if the cancer had been detected when it should have been, that there was would have been a 28% chance of survival. Is that, am I wrong?
The testimony, what the stipulation was among counsel was that the best case
30%,
scenario,
I think it was.
It was 28%. The best case scenario would be if plaintiff's expert will not testify at trial. His opinion, as set forth in his report, would be that with earlier diagnosis, the patient would have had a 28% chance of surviving 5 years.
So we're not talking about the chance of survival when the cancer was finally detected. It goes back to when. That's why it's such a difficult issue. It goes back to when the cancer should have been detected by the doctor and didn't detect it.
Plaintiff's expert was of the opinion that had it been detected in a more timely fashion, consistent with his opinion as to the standard of care, the patient would have had a 28% chance of surviving 5 years, and by the delay, that 28% chance was lost.
What factor, I didn't see it in the briefs, and maybe it's because it's not really any issue, but how do we factor in the fact that fortunately we probably all know someone who has been told you have a 28% chance of living because we've detected this disease and cancer, and the doctors are wrong. They live for a long period of time. Should we be thinking about that at all, or should we just look at this as a strictly a medical technical issue? That if someone says you had 28% chance of living back then, that's it. Should we not factor in the fact that many people do live beyond the time that their doctors tell them they're going to live? Because obviously this is not an exact. Doctors don't control people's lives.
I guess I don't understand your question.
My question is that let's assume 28% chance. This person had 28% chance, but who's to say that this person wouldn't have actually outlived that percentage that the medical expert says they would have had? I mean, it seems to me that we see increasingly, this is obviously not part of the record, but it seems to me we see increasingly that situation where someone has been given X number of years to live, or months or whatever, and they live well beyond that. Is that something that we should be thinking about, and whether or not we overrule Cooper or not?
I think you should be thinking about it for two reasons. Number one, emphasize pure speculation. Yes, anything's possible, and it's not fair that the physician be held liable in damages for a wrongful death with a slight possibility that the patient might have survived with better care. The other reason why I think it's important you should look at is because what happens in a situation where a person has, for example, a 28% chance of living, and because of the alleged malpractice, that chance reduced to 10%. There's still a 10% chance of surviving. What if that person survives? Does that mean the person has lost his 18% chance and recovers damages even though he's not been harmed at all? That would be the logical extension of the lost chance doctrine, that the person recovers damages who's not been harmed. Conversely, if the physician who allegedly provided negligent medical care reduced the chances from 28% to 10%, will end up being held liable for wrongful death damages for a loss of an 18% chance.
Counselor, I don't want to make your argument, but that's really not it, because if you say, and I was going to ask the same question the chief did, because I think it was being confused. The fact is that this determination is made at the date of examination. That's the percentage time that you have at the time. If it had been, if the examination had been properly thorough and this cancer had been discovered, at that moment you had a 28% chance to recover. That's the key date. Now, if that's the key date, then the fact that it went down to 10% by the time that it was finally discovered, the 28% was still the factor. So I don't see the logical extension you're talking about.
Well, I'm saying, if for example...
It's a logical extension to me.
Okay. Well, assuming hypothetically that we have a patient who would only have a 6% of survival,
mm-hmm.
take 28%, and because of the delay, the patient has 10%.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly a possible lost chance target. If you have an 18% difference, does that patient get...
I understood what you said, but it's applied at the 28% because it's the time that it wasn't discovered. The percentage of recovery, chances of recovery, loss of chance was 28%, not 18 or 10 or anything else. It was 28 because the date is set.
In this particular case, yes, I'm saying extension of loss chance time for another fact.
Well, but how? You'd go right back to the date that the original examination where the misdiagnosis took place. Why would you take it at a subsequent time?
All I'm saying is this particular case, are the chance went down to zero, but if it was, went down to 10% in different fact patterns.
You're talking about, in a medical malpractice case, not a wrongful death, I guess. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah,
once
and
you start down this road, perhaps that's the next step, is that in medical malpractice cases that are not wrongful death.
And that would be...
You're talking about chances between 50 and the death.
Exactly, and that was something that Mr. Strong wants to get into.
Which you don't need to do right now,
yes.
Because your time is here, less than 2 minutes. So Mr. Strong.
Can I just point out one thing before Mr. Strong speaks?
If you want to use his time, but your time is running.
I will. This is a wrongful death case, and I would just point out, this is a matter of statutory construction. There is no basis for a lost chance theory of recovery under a wrongful death statute. That may be the most important argument, which I have not yet made, and hope Mr. Strong will have a chance. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Mr. Strong.
To please the court, my name is Rick Strong and I represent Akron City Hospital in the case. I would like to start out with a comment about the statistics that have been discussed here this morning. I think it's kind of ironic that the appellant side of this case wants these statistics both ways. In some respects, in their briefs, they impugn statistics, talking about a pseudoscientific distinction between 51% and 49%, and over the fact that this type of approach and Cooper invites a battle of the experts, and there's some cynicism in there about statistics, but yet they rely heavily upon statistics both in their argument here this morning and in some of the various approaches to the allocation of damages that they argue for. Specifically, this bar graph that Mr. Lanciani touched on in his argument earlier this morning, which is exhibit one to their brief, is a table of 5-year survival rates for various cancers. And one of the arguments here relative to that bar graph was that medical practitioners are in essence immunized against lawsuits when the basic 5-year survival rate is below 50%. The fact is that the majority of cancers on that bar graph have survival rates, when it's a localized cancer, well above 50%. If there are 10 there, I think there are only 3 that present an initial 5-year survival rate below 50%. And as medicine advances, of course, those survival rates go up as well. This is not a static situation. I think that statistical use is a little deceptive. Furthermore, I believe that those statistics are simply 5-year rates, and therefore if you were talking about a survival claim and the ability of the patient to muster expert testimony above the 50% mark required by Cooper, certainly with lung cancer, esophageal cancer, and liver cancer, the three that start out with a 50% threshold, at some point along the continuum, the survival rate is above 50%. With the proper medical expert testimony, perhaps a survival claim could be advanced, which is not what is before this court today. This is simply a wrongful death case.
Do we take that to mean that if we overrule Cooper, this won't have a tremendous impact on hospitals?
If you overrule Cooper, it will have a tremendous impact on hospitals.
Well, if most have survival rates above 50%, then Cooper doesn't, and maybe I'm wrong, Cooper doesn't affect those cases, does it? Doesn't Cooper just affect the cases in which the survival rate is below 50%?
That's right. Now, Your Honor, I can't quote what the statistics are. I'm going on the bar graph, but certainly even with the cancers that are above the 50% mark, with advancements, there will be cases where the threshold for fiber survival is below 50%.
Yeah,
so this will
sure.
have an impact. I would also mention on statistics, there was some mention of the comparative negligence statute as a basis for the fact that we can compare. I would remind the court that the comparative negligence statute cuts off the plaintiff's recovery when the plaintiff's negligence exceeds that 50% point. There is a cutoff. We have cutoff lines in many places in the law, and this concept would be an abandonment of science. We were talking earlier in the discussion with Mr. Rice as to where the 50% comes from, the 51%. It comes from science. And science is extant in the courtroom, and this is an abandonment of science. And I would use the word pseudoscientific to characterize this damage approach, which would take a 15% survival rate, 14% survival rate, 30% survival rate, and then try to translate that into damages. Speaking of damages, I know my time's up, but I would next just mention the fact that this is a wrongful death case, and one of the cases heavily relied on by the appellants, the Falcon case in Michigan, characterizes loss of chance as a case that accrues prior to death. The death cases are damages that flow to the beneficiaries, and there are no damages in the character of those advanced by the appellants to be found in the wrongful death statute. And this, I believe, cuts off the inquiry. This is not a survival case. That issue is not before the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Strong. Ms. Ballard, I'm sorry, the appellees have used all their time. Thank you. We've got your brief, and the case has been well argued. Zarella, I want you to use your time, but take 1 minute for your comment.
Please, the court. We heard this morning a comment advanced that is both inflammatory and prejudicial. We hear it in the trial courts all the time, and that is a comment by Mr. Rice that this is a lottery. There's nothing about it, a lawsuit. It's a lottery, and someday I'm sure that the use of that term to defeat legitimate claims is going to be before this court. In 1867, this court said that any one of proper degree of skill and care which diminishes the chance of a patient's recovery would in a legal sense constitute injury. Justice Stratton, you asked the question about the distinction of Cooper and what about the case under 50%. I think that's the crux of why we're here. Cooper, I don't believe, should be overruled. Cooper should be modified to what it really stands for, and that is in every civil case in which a plaintiff advances a medical malpractice claim, there must be proof based upon a reasonable degree of medical probability of the proximate cause between negligence and injury. And that's really the essence of Cooper. However, the issue that brings us here today is the cause of action that fails because Cooper has been misinterpreted for Rhett Butler and everybody else who may have a claim where going in, it's under 50%. Now, we know Rhett Butler has a 70% chance of recovery, so that's over Cooper and we don't have to worry about it. But let's look at Butler's lifetime batting average. And he's one of the best center fielders who was playing in this game, and he hits about 200, his lifetime batting average is about 280. And in the major leagues, that's a tremendous percentage in life for those 28 people. It's their life. And up until now, if you ask about is the medical profession being unfairly treated or is somebody else being unfairly treated, the only people that are unfairly treated are those who going into a doctor's office for treatment before anything has happened have a chance of life. But the chance is less than 50%. And we're here asking you to give those people the same right of a cause of action as anybody who walks in with a skin lesion or a basal cell carcinoma that was excised from my eyebrow, where I have a 99% chance of survival.
Mr. Zavarella, how do you respond to Apley's argument that this doesn't have any place, this is a wrongful death action, and therefore it really has no place to be argued?
Well, I've heard that, I've read it, and I don't understand it, because any claim for medical malpractice, whether it be a survival action or whether it be a wrongful death, they all have to be interpreted based upon the same standard of law. Proximate cause, did proximate cause cause injury? Did proximate cause cause death? And whether or not proximate cause is the basis upon which, I'm talking myself a little. Proximate cause is no different in survivorship and in wrongful death. So I think it's a distinction without a difference.
You use your time, Mr. Zavarella.
But wait, that's question. Very important, and that's the same question I wanted to ask Judge Resnick did. What would your damages be in this case? What would you seek? Would it be the damages from the date of the time of the misdiagnosis for medical expense and pain and suffering, those things that might have been? Or is there a wrongful death claim here? What wrongful death claim could there be given the 28% freedom?
Given the standard that applies in Cooper, there is none.
Okay, I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.